In this next portion, we're actually going to look at a few potential case examples regarding our work with couples. With this segment, my hope is that we'll be able to kind of pull from all the different types of techniques that I've talked about today and kind of look holistically at each case, at all the different types of approaches that we might be able to use. Obviously, when we're actually doing this with clients, we're going to really individualize and tailor to each person and each couple. So in terms of treatment planning and using efficacious treatment approaches, we're going to pull from what's most important to the client or what they're saying are their most prominent presenting concerns. So let's start by looking at case example number one. Hannah and Bill have known each other for 22 years and been married for 17 years. They feel like what started out well has deteriorated to a level they never thought was possible. They feel like strangers and miss the sense of being partners or being a team that they used to have. They've endured so many things, from sudden death of one of their children, a miscarriage, loss of Bill's job, and ailing parents moving in with them while awaiting placement at a facility. They are giving the marriage one last ditch effort by coming in for counseling. They hope the foundation they once had years ago can be rekindled. So what's interesting to me is they're coming in describing this as a last ditch effort. They really feel like the relationship's gotten to a point where they're not so sure that they can continue. What also strikes me about this, though, is that they've known each other for 22 years and been married for 17 years. So they have quite a long history already where they've endured, they've persevered. They've obviously done something right through the years, through the ups and downs. There's a list in here of things that they've already endured. Death, loss, changes, ailing parents. Any one of those is a significant life stressor. And when we take multiple ones together, obviously they pile up. At one point, I would be tempted to talk with them using a solution-focused approach. I would look at the question of how did you manage in spite of deaths, miscarriage, losses, job changes, health issues with parents. Those are pretty important, significant issues. You've had to pull together for quite a long time. It's not like you were married yesterday, but been married for 17 years. And I might even ask them about what is it that got them to the point of saying, you know, we've endured, we've persevered through so many major ups and downs, but now we're not sure we can do it anymore. It's interesting that they're saying the foundation that they had, they're not sure that it can be rekindled. So I might actually go back to talking about what that foundation was. It's kind of hard to do work with couples if we're not very specific and concrete and behavioral. So I would look at what was happening back then, whether it's when they first met, whether it's early on in the marriage, or a while back, even if they felt like it's been a long time, what was happening? What would that camera and that idea of the imaginary camera check see in terms of concrete behavioral things? Oftentimes you find with couples that initially when they get together, they notice things as strengths, but over the years, those same things that they word in terms of strengths, like this person's flexible, they change it later to, oh gosh, they're too laid back. Or this person's a great planner and organizer. They're able to juggle a lot at once. They change that to, wow, they're so rigid. It's annoying. I'm also wondering, with having so many layers of stresses, what either of them individually or as a couple has done to process grief. Any one of those is a significant loss. How have they grieved? And have they even had time in between all those losses to look at the question of what do they need? Have they had support people through the years other than themselves? Do they have other couples? Do they have relatives? Do they have community resources? Because we know that building support systems is always an important factor. I would look at what has been things that turn them on, that draw them closer to each other, and what have been some turnoffs. I would look at their problem solving. They've obviously managed somehow to problem solve, but it sounds like the mentality that they have now is that where they're at this present time is either too big of a problem or too much piled on top of the other things, that it's really hard to really problem solve at this point. So I might even inquire as to what is different about this point compared to the past problems. Immediately, what comes to mind is the idea of peeling the onion, just all the layers. And when layer after layer has just happened and you just manage through, it's easy to get to a point where you're just exhausted. And so self-care would also be an element that I would highlight. Let's take a look at case example two here. This is the example of David and Lisa. David has recently come clean to his wife Lisa about having an affair on her with someone from his work. He has agreed to be accountable and willingly let his wife see phone records. While David appears to be remorseful and has verbalized that he wants to be committed to his marriage, Lisa still harbors suspicions that he's just not disclosing everything since he saw the other woman attempt to text him. How is your day going? Even though David did not respond. It is to the point that Lisa keeps David up all night with endless questions to see if she can catch him and any lies. David feels like, according to Lisa, he will never have paid a big enough price for his wife to be convinced that he's committed only to her. How do you proceed with them? So obviously, a real wound and a real indiscretion has occurred. When we're talking about David being genuinely remorseful, I'm wondering what sort of apologies he's given her. And I'm also wondering if at this point, because of the hurt and pain she's going through, if really any apology, even a healthy one, really will make her feel like they can move forward in the marriage. I would think there may be some individual work that each of them needs to do, especially Lisa. I remember working with a couple that's pretty similar to this example in my actual practice, and I found out in that situation that when the husband had an affair, that it really triggered the wife because she had some PTSD issues from the past in other relationships and with some abuse and trauma issues where it just kept playing over and over and over, and it was hard for her to shut it off. We might need to do some individual work with her about what happens when the automatic thoughts replaying this incident come to her. When she's hypervigilant, when she has these memories, maybe she has pictures in her mind of what she thinks they may have done. Maybe she has questions. And hopefully when we're working with them as a couple, we can also facilitate a foundation of how much communication do they want to have on this topic. There needs to be some agreement about that. So because she's very wounded and because this is triggering her, it is important for David to be willing to have some level of communication with her. There may be questions she has. There's definitely uncertainty she has about the likelihood of this potentially happening again, either with this other woman from work or with someone else. I do like the fact, and I think it's a positive, and definitely would highlight it in their marriage counseling, that he is agreeing to be accountable. He's coming into the counseling with you and with his wife. He's letting his wife see his phone records. But it also sounds, on the other hand, like she's at a place that even when she sees his phone records and sees him, the other woman, attempting to say, how is your day going, that even though he's transparent about that, that she interprets that as, she's still talking to you. I would be tempted to ask her about, will there ever be a point at which, while there still need to be ongoing forgiveness and there's ongoing working through, at which you feel like he has, quote unquote, paid for what he's done, that the remorse is genuine and we can actually move on. It was interesting when I asked this question to one woman that I had worked with before. She was very honest and she said, you know, I don't know if there'll ever be a point. Because the questions keep happening, the thoughts are keeping me up at night, the shock is being relived. So some of the work with her is working through the trauma, but some with him is also helping him provide reassurance that if he is genuinely committed to being accountable, that they have people that they can go to about their marriage who will be upfront with them. If he has struggles that maybe he's not getting at home what he wants in his relationship with Lisa and is tempted to go to someone else, if he's frustrated with her questions, if she's frustrated with him, they need to have other couples, other mentors, other people they can go to. Not just the counseling with you, but also some accountability people. And there should be accountability on both people's part. Accountability for her. There needs to be a point also at which she's kept in check about when she's asking these questions. If he is willing to answer the questions and talk with her and endure through this difficult process at some point, if there's no evidence to the contrary saying that he's continuing to have affairs, how can she continue to believe this and punish him as if he's having the ongoing affair? There's a lot of emotional healing that needs to happen and a lot of rebuilding. So some of the emotion-focused therapy and some of the marriage therapies, like the ones that were described by Everett Worthington, that are hope-focused, may be especially meaningful. I also find that actual concrete lessons in the session, where verbally and in writing, each person is stating a commitment to kind of reinvest in the marriage. Whether it's a little, you know, renewal of vows, a new pledge. And then I also find with that a lot of couples, if they put that up, frame it in the house, give it to each other as a gift, but really do that emotional working through. Remember, it's not a quick and easy process. It's an intimate dance back and forth. It takes time. And it may seem like at one point it's, quote, resolved, and then all of a sudden there's another trigger. So that's something that there may be some individual counseling as well as work together as a couple. Let's look at the next case example. Mary Lou has had a string of relationships that haven't worked out. She's unsure what it is that keeps happening. Hesitant to even let down her guard and try another relationship, she eventually gives in to fiancé Mario's advances. For the most part, things have been going well. Yesterday was the day of their one-year anniversary as a couple. Mario indicated that he made special plans for the two of them. After waiting a half hour beyond the time Mario was supposed to meet her, Mary Lou began to think she should just call it quits, just like the other relationships. Remember we talked in today's seminar about attributions and assumptions. It would be very easy for the thought error of emotional reasoning to come in and be like, doggone it, every time I've tried a relationship, it doesn't work out. Something goes bad. It will be easy for Mary Lou to get to that conclusion. And then, here, I'm even at the point of engagement with Mario. And look, he lets me down. So maybe there needs to be some work with her about realistic letdowns. And also differentiating between intentional letdowns and unintentional letdowns. Waiting a half hour beyond the time they're supposed to meet is certainly frustrating. I imagine there's a lot of things that have gone through her head. And we probably will want to process with her in helping her identify what those thought errors are. The problem, though, however, is that basically that she's making assumptions that it's something big, it's something awful, even to the point that she's thinking maybe they should call it quits. I would use some of the cognitive debating strategies that we talked about in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy. Things like, is this a fact or just an opinion? Is it a fact that this big, awful something that you think happened is the reason why Mario's late? Is it a fact that he's just like everybody else you've ever had a relationship with, and he's not invested, and maybe you should think twice about being engaged? If you think it is, what evidence do you have to this? Is there any evidence to show differently that he might not be like the other people? That while he's imperfect and has things that will let you down, as well as Mary Lou, you having things that will let him down, let's look at really what evidence do we have of a negative intention. I always tell couples it's important to get their information to really see what the facts would suggest. Was he caught up in traffic? Did his phone die that he wasn't able to talk with her and tell her? Did something happen to the car? Was he stopping to get her a gift and a card and he thought he'd be able to get it earlier and wasn't able to till now? There's a lot of possibilities. And we have to make sure the evidence really shows what the truth is rather than just what she's magnified in her mind. So, continuing on this example, we see that it was easy for her to scream accusations initially, saying she knew deep down that he was just like everyone else, that he couldn't keep the act going on any longer, that he hadn't called, so she's sure that it is a lie. She says it's a rotten day to do this, but I knew the truth would come out. So you see, a good dinner or event together could really go sour if Mario jumps right into just reacting to Mary Lou's suspicions. When she's saying, I knew it, you're just like this person. It's easy. She's using those horsemen that we talked about that Gottman reminded us to avoid. And this might be a perfect time for them to look at how do we engage in some of our pre-planned conflict management strategies. If he has the patience, it might be good for him to talk with her and just, first of all, hear her out. Do some perspective taking. So I hear you saying that this is a deep letdown again. And I know you've told me that you've gone through so many letdowns in relationships to this point. And here I am letting you down in your way of looking at it. Would you mind me being able to give you an explanation of what happened? No excuses, just the facts of what happened. And it may be that time needs to pass for her to really be able to pull back. Remember, her thoughts are automatic thoughts based on what she's lived through in the past. Not necessarily correct, but there's a grain of truth and there's some lie in there. Let's look at example number 4. I wish Mike would just problem solve when things get tense, says Kathy. I feel like I'm always pulling him to talk, share, yell, just respond. He seems to withdraw and not do or say anything. Sure, he says he doesn't want to make things worse for us by saying something we will regret, but when he clams up, it is way worse for me. I feel like we're getting no closer to a solution. We don't problem solve. We just sweep things under the rug until time passes and they don't matter anymore. I'm tired of feeling like we don't make an effort to work through anything. So I'm not sure if Mike and Kathy in this situation would both be willing to come into counseling, or if she's just coming in saying how frustrated she is. If they're both coming in, we can definitely teach them about those 4 horsemen that Gottman talks about withdrawing. It may be that he had great intentions in terms of withdrawing from a fight to not escalate it. So that might be something we want to affirm, but it may have been that in his withdrawing, he forgot or didn't think to set a time for when they're going to get back to things and problem solve. Kathy may be the type of person, which it sounds like, that wants to, quote, solve things right away. As I said, in almost every couple, you have one person who's kind of pulling for continuing to talk and work through and problem solve and go round and round about an issue. And usually there's another person who's like, whoa, this has gone too far. Let's create a pause in here. So we need to create a plan for when they go through problems. It doesn't matter what the problem topic is. We need to create a plan for each of them to be able to slow down, to be able to speak using an iMessage what their concern is. I'm sure when Kathy's upset, she's probably not very likely using iMessages with Mike. So helping her to do that, and then helping each of them to do some perspective taking. It's interesting that Kathy even brings up, sure, he says that he doesn't want to make things worse for us. I might be tempted in the middle of the session to say, okay, let's pause for a minute. What did you just say? Let's repeat that. He doesn't want to make things worse for us. He doesn't want things to escalate. That's an important fact in the story. So he doesn't want to make things worse, but the two of you aren't sure what to do to problem solve from there. I also might explore with her, or with both of them if they're willing to come in, have they ever had, on any issue, a quote-unquote successful problem-solving resolution? Not one where someone just walked away, not one where there was explosion and accusation, but something where they actually successfully worked through a problem. If they've been together for any length of time, if they did, even at one point, even a long time ago, what did that look like? And is it possible that we can do that again? Now let's look at case example number 5. Elizabeth has always had a bit of a perfectionistic streak. Deep down, she thinks that if she puts forth outrageous effort, then maybe someday someone will really, really love her. Leonard has tried giving her gifts, helping around the house, and being extra affectionate with Elizabeth, only to realize that she still feels insecure about the relationship every time there are what he calls, quote, normal couple discussions. Elizabeth brings in her journal to counseling to share what she wrote. All my life I've tried so hard to be the good daughter, good friend, good wife, but it seems like nothing is ever good enough for anybody. My parents never loved me. Now my husband doesn't love me either. He never tells me how much I'm worth to him or the difference it makes of me being in his life. So it's interesting that when we're working with Elizabeth, initially she's focusing on the incident with Leonard. Then it broadens to many situations in her life about being unloved by parents, about her husband, about not being good enough. So I'm wondering how much of it is really about Leonard and how much of it might also be about her and how she experiences love. Remember we talked about how couples often use similar words, but they define them differently? Words such as love. Just because couples say they both want to be loved and to love each other doesn't mean they define that the same way. It sounds like Leonard's definitely made some attempts. He's been affectionate, he's given gifts, he's helped around the house. I would be tempted to talk with them about things like the love languages books and kind of looking at how can he love Elizabeth the way she needs to be loved. Maybe those aren't the ways that she most experiences love. Maybe she needs reassurance because of how she processes things. She may also need some individual counseling about these long-standing patterns. It's interesting how we act out some of the beliefs, the schemas, and the patterns from our childhood and from other relationships and our later relationships. So that might be something. I would probably also work with Leonard about affirming the fact that he is making attempts because he may feel defeated. He's saying that there's just normal discussions. These are just normal things. And they might be. But to Elizabeth, because she's perfectionistic, because she's had wounds in the past, they're not normal. So it might be useful to look at how does she know what a, quote, normal couple interaction is, even when it becomes rocky, even when it becomes difficult. I also would work with Elizabeth on the fact, because she's talking about, I'm not good enough, people don't love me, I'm sure they don't love me. On the one hand, we could look at, from a concrete behavioral level, how she experiences love. But on the other hand, we could look at how, while there may be some responsibility the other has for loving us, that we can't fully expect all our love just to come from the other person. We may need to work with her about how can she learn to love herself. If she really believes that she's worthy of love, what can she do to extend that to herself and not just be bitter at other people for not doing what she thinks that they should do? I also would talk with her about how has she really communicated what love is or how she experiences that or what she needs? All too often, I've had couples where they expect someone to know almost this unspoken rule about how they experience things, and then they punish their spouse for not doing what they're quote-unquote supposed to do, even though they may not have told them directly. Let's look at the sixth example here. My partner doesn't care about our place. He just covers the shelves in front of our pictures with ridiculous, dusty knickknacks to where I can't even see our photos anymore, says Rick. Those are our memories. When he keeps piling useless stuff around our pictures, it's like he's trying to cover us up. So there's some assumptions that Rick's partner just doesn't hold their relationship valuable. There is an assumption here by Rick, too, that it's intentional, that putting the knickknacks in front of the picture is something that he must have known he was doing. I would use some cognitive debating skills to look at. Is that a fact? It sounds like that your partner likes to collect a lot of ridiculous dusty knickknacks. Not just in front of your picture, but kind of all over the shelves. And maybe it's not just an issue of is it blocking your picture, but having differences of opinion about your place and what constitutes valuing your place. Let's look at the next example here. My roommate Jeanette is so lazy. She purposely doesn't care about the place I work so hard to provide for us. She takes forever to pick up dirty laundry and then takes eternity to hang up clean laundry. Our place doesn't even feel like home anymore. She doesn't even try to make time to do anything to show that our place means anything to her. Her only contribution to us is to make dinner for us every now and then. I think tonight I'll be going straight to my room. Why eat her dinner when she does nothing to contribute to this relationship? I can be just as lazy and uninterested. So, again, there were assumptions that each of them may have made about the place. There's personality descriptions being used. Jeanette is lazy. She doesn't care. She's disinterested. And one of the things we specifically talked about was the importance of moving away from personality descriptions that would make the other person defensive to stuff like concrete behavioral desired actions. So we might work with the person coming in about how she can use more I messages. I felt so excited when we got this place together. To me, getting the place together meant, quote unquote, you know, whatever about our relationship. Now I'm kind of worried about us and whether or not we're on good footing when it feels like there's so many undone things around our place. I'm wondering what we can do to get to these things. The other thing I specifically would deal with the person who's speaking in this example, it says, why eat Jeanette's dinner when she does nothing to contribute? And I'm thinking, wait a minute, she did make dinner. So we might go to some of the exercises that we talked about in terms of tasks. Who does what tasks and what is the worth of each task? Because it sounds like this person is assuming that the making of dinner is less valuable, less important, or holds less weight than keeping up with the cleaning and the laundry. So that's something that we might look at. We might also look at what is love, what is togetherness, what actions in both of their opinion represent a commitment to the relationship. Because honestly, it may not be that Jeanette's even thinking that she's not committed to the relationship. She may think that maybe making the meals is an excellent commitment, and maybe she's prioritizing that because she knows they need to eat and making that choice instead of the laundry. Let's look at case example number 8. I remember when we talked about our goals before we got married. Jim and I talked about raising a family and creating memories together. Now, all I hear about is saving up for the deck out back and the remodeled extra room upstairs. How did our dreams become so different? Remember when we talked about dreaming together? And we talked about being careful not to crush each other's dreams, even if they sound a little bit unrealistic. It's interesting that on the one hand, this person saying that Jim is still sharing dreams. Dreams about the deck and dreams about the extra room. He's not shutting his dream down. Just because she may have different dreams doesn't mean that they're on bad footing. Part of the relationship is learning to dream with each other, whether the dreams are exactly the same or whether they're somewhat different. Let's look at the next example here. Case example number 8. Deanna had a heated argument with her husband, Jeff. I've put up with your weird, crazy relationship with your mother for too long. She's always around. Her opinions are in your head. She just shows up whenever she wants. You've taken Mama's boy to a new level. Why can't you just be a man and quit catering to that old woman? Stand up once for yourself and for us. Get a backbone. You seem more married to her than me. Now, remember the exercise we talked about earlier in the seminar about setting your marriage table. I think it would be interesting to do some work about how this couple obviously defines differently how close of interactions they want with extended family, with in-laws, with friends, with other people. So that's a discussion that I would have hoped they would have had maybe in premarital work, but they may not have had it, or both of them may have had some strong opinions, so much so that they were just going to take those on into the marriage. So it's important to go back to what those assumptions are and to look at what the agreement is. The way in which Deanna is responding, you know, basically considering her husband weak, saying that he has a crazy relationship with the mom, calling him Mama's boy, saying he has no backbone, probably is very demeaning to him. He experiences it most likely as name-calling and cutting down. We want to stay away from those descriptions and those adjectives. Instead, talking about, it seems like mom coming over is important to you. I want to understand how you feel when there's the idea of your mom coming over. It seems like we might be on pretty different wavelengths about what the ideal amount of interaction with your mom or with other people looks like. I'm wondering if we can talk about what the plan is about how often we want other people in our house and what that looks like. I remember one counselor who was a PhD and he was a minister as well down in Cincinnati. And in his premarital work with couples, that was something he did across the board as he talked with them about the couple themselves coming to a point of agreement of how much allotment of time do we give for other people versus our marriage, versus our job, versus other activities. And deciding that ahead of time. So when the in-laws do call, so when someone does show up unexpectedly, there is a system about how do we handle that. I'm not sure how much Deanna and Jeff actually talked about that. It's also important to look at what was the pattern before the marriage. I know there's been situations where kids had to grow up before their time and be almost like the surrogate dad. Or maybe the father died. Maybe the dad was always working. Maybe Jeff had to take extra responsibility growing up and grew close to help the mom. Maybe his mom is going through some health issues and he feels like she doesn't have much time left and he wants to make the most of it. So it's important to facilitate that discussion between Deanna and Jeff about their assumptions about things and then laying some foundation. Let's look at case example number 10 here. John says to his partner defensively, "Okay, okay, are you happy now? I said I'm sorry for whatever is getting to you. What more do I need to do now to make you happy?" So, right off the bat, the thing that comes to my mind is, this isn't a healthy apology. It's really not an apology, honestly. It's more an effort to shut things up. It's shutting down the relationship. It's almost like the withdrawing. Even though John might not be physically walking away from the partner, he's trying to quickly shut down the communication, the conversation, and really not hear out the partner. I would do some work on helping teach and reinforce the communication game. I don't hear any checking in with the partner about what the partner's experiencing. There's no check-in about, are you feeling such and such? You're feeling that because blank about that person's perception of situations. There's no check-in about what it is they're wanting. There's also no problem solving. Remember I stated that with a genuine apology, you're able to actually summarize what the other person's going through. So something along the lines of, I'm sorry for leading you to feel betrayed when I shared some of our important confidences with other people. And then to talk about what the plan for the future is. In the future, in order for us to have more trust in our relationship, I'm wondering if we could, and then lead to some specific planned behavior. In order for apology to be genuine, there needs to be, in my opinion, and in much of the literature, a very specific commitment, very specific plans of what are we going to do here. Not in a sarcastic way, as John's doing, what more do I need to do now? But in a genuine, understanding, empathic way. Now let's look at the 11th example here. My spouse can't possibly think I'm attractive this way. I've gained so much weight since having those kids. No wonder he comes home late from work and collapses in bed. Thinking of being close with me is probably the last thing on his mind. So it sounds like this woman is really feeling bad about herself. She's definitely assuming that the reason that he's collapsing after work isn't because he's tired from work, isn't because he needs sleep, or some other possible explanation, but it's because of her. I think sometimes just a very common sense approach is the best. What would it be like for her to ask her husband? I don't know if she's not asking because she doesn't want to hear the answer or because she wants to believe what she already thinks about, I'm sure he's not interested in me. But my thing would be, even if that's part of the truth, is that the 100% total truth? Can there be more than one reason that he's collapsing? Can he be tired from work? Can he be worn out? Did he not get a good sleep the night before? Was work extra hard? So it's important to have those discussions. It might be useful, too, if they're able to come in together to look at the concept of vulnerability. Remember early on in the seminar today, we talked about filling in the blanks on that one formula about when we say this or do this, it makes me feel vulnerable. There's a lot of things that trigger that fear of vulnerability. But the fact is, I'm sure that if they've been together for any length of time, they've had some discussions to this point about challenging topics. My concern is that regardless of if they talk about it or not, she's still believing something that may be at least in part a lie. So I would ask her, is this what you want to believe? Is this really what you want to do from here? Is it life-giving at all to continue to think this way? Is it helping you? Is it helping you draw closer in the relationship? Or what is it doing? Thank you again for studying this topic of building intimacy with couples with me. I look forward to you hopefully joining me for other seminars, either online or in person. And I wish you well in your therapy work. Thank you. Bye.